8. Image, imagination, inspiration. What is man's body? It is a spark from the fire. It meets water, and it is put out. What is man's body? It is a bit of straw. It meets fire and is burnt. What is man's body? It is a bubble of water, broken by the wind. A Gond poem from central India. Image and metaphor. We might call someone daft as a brush, a mother feeling the child in her womb as especially vigorous might say it's like a frog in a sock. Faced with an important decision, we often say we are at the crossroads. On a good day, things are looking up. All these phrases are making use of the figure of speech known as metaphor. There are many different types of metaphor, but they share the characteristic of saying one thing in terms of another. At the heart of metaphor, the vehicle which connects the subject of the utterance with the quality being evoked is something palpable, usually visual, an image, the brush, the crossroads, the act of lifting the eyes. In the poem at the head of this chapter, our body is first a spark, then a piece of straw, then a bubble. Metaphor is often seen to be the essence of the poetic, and prose that is coloured in such ways is often labelled poetic. But poetry does not have a monopoly on metaphor, or upon the vivid evocations of descriptive imagery. The historian, Bede, 673 to 735, likened human life to the flight of a bird that happens to swoop through a window and crosses a lighted hall before disappearing once more into the dark. Daily speech and prose of many kinds will often try to paint pictures and to use metaphor, and not only to decorate a passage. Metaphor and its infinite variety of images are intrinsic to human language, and because consciousness of language is inseparable from poetry, we are bound to look at how it works and at some of the interesting questions that follow. At its simplest, in the simile, the metaphoric connection is explicitly made by using like or as. Here, Anne Askew, 1521 to 46, begins her poem, The Ballad, which Anne Askew made and sang when she was in Newgate, with a simile, like as the armed knight, appointed to the field. With this world will I fight, and faith shall be my shield. In other works, the metaphorical intention will be more implicit, and sometimes more sustained, as in this anonymous lyric, The Silver Swan, dated at 1612, and set to music by Orlando Gibbons, 1583 to 1625. The silver swan who living had no note, when death approached, unlocked her silent throat, leaning her breast against the reedy shore, thus sung her first and last, and sung no more. Farewell, all joys. O death, come close mine eyes. More geese than swans now live, more fools than wise. Whatever sad event or melancholy mood inspired the poet, we will read this as a human lament. The swan is a figure through which the human voice complains not only of death, but of the condition of the world she leaves behind. The notion that the swan is mute until its last moments presents the neat poignancy, especially for a poet, of first words being last words and vice versa. Perhaps, too, the swan's muteness is a figure of restraint, which makes her final condemnation of the world that much more powerful. The silver swan works as an extended metaphor, or conceit. That is a figure of speech that is carried on beyond one moment's likening to develop a substantial idea. Conceit is an interesting word in this context. The word has two tendencies within its meaning. First, It can mean an idea or conception, but we are most likely to think of a second sense associated with self-regard and vanity. Our literary term has something of both implications, for it carries an idea, but the working through of the metaphor is likely to display an ingenuity, which some readers will find affected and self-admiring, as though the poet is keener to show off than to say something significant. 17th century poetry has often been disparaged for being lost in conceits, and the Oxford English Dictionary quotes one commentator who praises the classical Greek poets for ignoring such fancy elaboration. They did not call the waves nodding hearse plumes, or laburnums, dropping wells of fire. Words and things as they are. This takes us deep into one of the most ancient controversies about poetry, and indeed language. The essence of human language is that it puts one thing in place of another thing. That is, that it makes unrelated sounds. And later, their accompanying visual symbols stand in for objects in the world and what occurs in our minds. Metaphor, this further standing in place of, extends this remove. Words are already images of the things they represent, signifiers of what they signify. But metaphors are images of images. Writing on the theory of art in Book 10 of The Republic, the Greek philosopher Plato, 327 to 247 BC, saw poetic language as refracting reality. He likened this crucial difference between how a thing is and how words can represent it to the way refraction makes a stick look bent when it is put in water. This difference made Plato and other philosophers and other thinkers uneasy. They worry that the capacity of language to invent and elaborate, for its sounds and images to work upon the emotions, can carry us away from reality and truth. We will notice, of course, that Plato's image of the stick in water makes his argument clearer. The developing scientific culture of the 17th century also put a high premium on simple clarity in speaking and writing, and set its face against the ease, vanity of fine speaking. Sir Thomas Spratt, in The History of the Royal Society, 1667, complained of the many mists and uncertainties these specious tropes and figures have brought on our knowledge. Rather than pretty conceits, it is interesting that the feminizing adjective pretty is often applied here. We should aim, argued Spratt, for a plain, direct language which has as many words as there be things, and no more. Rhetoric. Despite these anxieties, the Greeks and every part of Western culture since has acknowledged and sought to deploy the power of words. So much of social life, and especially public life, involves persuasion. As soon as a parent encounters the question, why? At least some part of her response is going to involve persuasion. Teachers must find ways of engaging their pupils in their subject. Lawyers seek to convince juries, and of course politicians aim to sway us towards voting for them. All are using rhetoric. That is language shaped to persuade. The full effect, however, has never been confined simply to the words themselves. The great Athenian orator, Demosthenes, 383 to 22 BC, is said to have had to overcome a stutter. The legend says he did so by practicing his delivery with a pebble in his mouth and pitching his voice against the sound of the sea. Nowadays, all manner of public figures take advice on how to present themselves on television and elsewhere. The pitch of the voice and the choice of a jacket are part of rhetorical effect. part indeed of another, newer sense of image. But our primary interest here is with the verbal dimension of rhetoric. We have already explored how different tones, such as anger, pathos, and humour, can be represented in poetic forms. Chapter 3, Tones of Voice. Within these registers, orators deploy particular constructions of phrase for effect. They might, for instance, begin a series of sentences in exactly the same way. Martin Luther King's 1929-68 celebrated civil rights speech, which reiterates the phrase, "I have a dream that, I have a dream that, I have a dream today," at the opening of each paragraph, is an example of this. Such devices, or rhetorical figures, are quite deliberate, and many generations of students and orators, following the models of antiquity, like Demosthenes and the Roman Cicero, 106-43 BC, practiced them assiduously and knew all their specific names. One of them, anaphora, the figure used by King in his speech, we have encountered in a variety of contexts already. We do not need to explore the particulars of classical rhetoric here, but it is important to recognise that there is a long tradition in which its deliberate strategies are also part of poetry. The Roman orator, Cicero, declared that the poet is very near kinsman of the orator, by which he meant that both aim to use all the resources of language, both intellectual and sensuous, to persuade the listener or reader. Of course, if we become too aware of the design the poet or orator has upon us, then we might recoil, thinking that we are being got at, even conned. This is why we often use the word rhetoric pejoratively, as in, "that's just rhetoric," meaning that the words sound good but lack substance. For a poet like Alexander Pope, who worked with the grain of this classical rhetorical tradition, devices must appear to arise in the argument simply to clarify what we can easily recognise as true. He puts it neatly in these lines from An Essay on Criticism. "True wit is nature to advantage dressed. What oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed. Something whose truth, convinced at sight we find, that gives us back the image of our mind." But the 18th century neoclassical tradition Pope represents sees poetry as at heart rhetorical, that is, that it consciously deploys the armoury of metre, rhythm, syntax, metaphor, image, tone, word choice and word sound, in the interests of clarity and argument. Moreover, this implies an actual or potential consensus of poet and audience. The audience will recognise in the poet's words what they in fact already knew to be true. Moreover, it is the character of poetry, through its own techniques, to be especially impressive and memorable. At the end of his Anatomy of the World, John Donne evokes God speaking to the prophet Moses. "He spake to Moses to deliver unto all that song, because he knew they would let fall the law, the prophets, and the history, but keep the song still in their memory." The song, the poem, will stay fixed in the people's mind after commandments or the prophets' proses are forgotten. So we have a long, rumbling argument, because it is a highly gestured, emphatic utterance and often makes greater use of metaphoric and descriptive imagery. Along with other verbal devices, poetry can have great rhetorical power. But these very qualities can also be seen to give it a dangerous potency. After all, we can be persuaded to words bad as well as good. Thus, poetry has often been seen as the distracting enemy of truth, and right reason whether religious or scientific. The possibility that poetry might signify nothing has been a horror to many for centuries, as well as a source of joy to others. Image and meaning. The clash of substance and fantasy in poetry is wittily evoked in John Ashbery's 1927 to 2017 poem about the process of writing a poem, and Ut Pictura Poesis is her name. Ut Pictura Poesis translates as in painting, so in poetry. After a few lines, says the poet, the poem needs a few important words, low-keyed, dull-sounding ones. But as soon as these are provided by the comically mundane information that she approached me about buying her desk, the poem is in a street full of bananas and the clangor of Japanese instruments. The poet ponders this seesaw. Something ought to be written about how this affects you when you write poetry. The extreme austerity of an almost empty mind, colliding with the lush, Rousseau-like foliage of its desire to communicate, something between breaths, if only for the sake of others and of their desire to understand you and desert you. For other centres of communication, so that understanding may begin, and in doing so, be undone. Ashbery's idea is that disciplined, highly focused verbal communication will be so austere it could come only from an almost empty mind. But the desire to communicate is never so austere, but resembles, and inevitably a metaphor now appears, a luxuriant multicoloured forest full of monkeys and tigers, of the kind painted by the French artist Douaniere, Rousseau. For this poet, imagery seems to be the condition of thought. Imagination. Now, if we put together image and the related noun, imagination, we bring to mind a powerful concept regarding the nature of poetry. Our rhetorical poets, formulating their careful arguments, or the makers of the traditional ballad, who did not seek for novelty and surprise in their metaphors, but just to tell a communal story, might be seen as constructors of poetry. There might even be said to be something mechanical about their method. By contrast, imagination suggests a quite different definition of poetry. Poetry is seen not as conscious process, but as natural surprise, an utterance lifted from the non-rational processes of the mind. Unbidden, associations and illuminations spring into the poet's mind, and thence to the page. Imagination has often been regarded suspiciously. The words vain and false have often been attached to it. For Samuel Johnson, 1709 to 84, imagination was a negative state of mind he associated with depression. Imagination never takes such firm possession of the mind as when it is found empty and unoccupied. But for the romantic poets, following hard upon Johnson at the end of the 18th century, the mental processes lying in the empty and unoccupied mind would be welcomed as absorbing and, in some profound sense, truer than the processes of the conscious mind. In William Wordsworth's 1770 to 1850 early poem, Expostulation and Reply, the poet's good friend Matthew accuses him of idleness. The poet replies, "The eye it cannot choose but see. We cannot bid the ear be still. Our bodies feel where they be, against or with our will. Nor less I deem that there are powers, which of themselves our minds impress, that we can feed this mind of ours in a wise passiveness." In a companion poem, The Tables Turned, he exhorts his friend to quit his books. "Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives. Our minds can absorb knowledge passively, intuitively. What better justification could you have for closing these particular barren leaves right now? These poems of Wordsworth's are, of course, themselves rhetorical, in that they seek to persuade Matthew, and by extension us as readers. But we see here a commitment to a different kind of knowing, a different kind of mental action. It is imagination in the sense of the mind's capacity to form concepts beyond those devised from external objects. The articulation of such apprehensions becomes one of the major tasks of Wordsworth's poetry, and again, he recalls moments, often from childhood, and usually alone in the natural world, when such strange, profound sensations overtake him. Herein there was a boy. He is beside the glimmering lake at nightfall, imitating owls and listening to the echoes of his voice, come back over the river from the surrounding hills. Then, sometimes, in that silence, while he hung, listening, a gentle shock of mild surprise has carried far into his heart the voice of mountain torrents or the visible scene, would enter unawares into his mind, with all its solemn imagery, its rocks, its woods, and that uncertain heaven received, into the bosom of the steady lake. What is carried far into his heart enters unawares into his mind, and is impossible to paraphrase. Wordsworth is not trying to convey a shared idea that his rhetorical skill will make us recognize, but to express something from his own deep experience that is at or beyond the limits of words. It is not an idea that oft was thought, but an experience unique to him. Poetry is the means by which he can seek to recall and understand such mild surprise, and aim to put it before others. Poetry can do this because of its elasticity as a medium, and because its sensuousness, especially the movements of its rhythms, can embody the charged excitement he remembers. Poetry now seems to be coming as though from elsewhere. The poet is inspired. Inspiration is one of the great clichés associated with poetry. Until confronted by the cold realities of creative writing class, would-be poets loitered by guttering candles, impatient for the moon flash of the poem's arrival. As all my emphasis so far upon craft and artifice suggests, poetry is not always and only the product of such miraculous moments. Nonetheless, and however easy it is to satirize the poet's earnest expectancy, the experience of inspiration and what it means for poetry needs to be taken very seriously. Inspiration, in this sense, is a metaphorical term. Its ground is the literal act of breathing, the taking in of air, respiration. Walt Whitman, 1819-92, at the outset of Song of Myself, gathers his poetic forces, in part, through the act of breathing. Indeed, his poetic being is intensely physical as it carries through to the voice. My respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves, and of the shore, and dark-coloured sea rocks, and the hay of the barn, the sound of the belched words of my voice loosed to the eddies of the wind. For Whitman, poetic inspiration is part of the untutored natural world. The lusty character of his poetic sensibility is marked here in the literalness of phrases like the passing of blood and air through my lungs, and the wonderful, arrestingly unpoetic, belched words. Inspiration for Whitman is no delicate zephyr. This natural association has always been present in the metaphorical sense of inspiration. First, it described religious experience where it is a breathing or infusion into the mind or soul. Oxford English Dictionary. The great translator, William Tyndall, 1494 to 1536, wrote of scripture given by inspiration of God. Later, it acquired the more general meaning, the suggestion, awakening, or creation of some feeling or impulse, especially of an exalted kind, OED, even if, occasionally, it might come courtesy of less exalted means. Thomas Hogg writes in his Life of Shelley of the soft inspiration of strong sound ale. There is always something unbidden about the coming of such suggestion, awakening, feeling, impulse. Ralph Waldo Emerson, 1803-82, in his essay The Poet, 1844, writes that the poet knows that he speaks adequately only when he speaks somewhat wildly. He describes the process like this. As the traveller, who has lost his way, throws his reins on his horse's neck, and trusts to the animal to find his road, so must we do with the divine animal who carries us through the world. For, if in any manner we can simulate this instinct, new passages are open for us into nature. The mind flows into and through things hardest and highest, and the metamorphosis is possible. Essays, 1942, page 218. He goes on to say that the quest to simulate this instinct is why bards love wine, mead, narcotics, coffee, tea, opium, the fumes of sandalwood and tobacco. All these too have their place among the familiar accessories of poetic inspiration. Emerson, however, regards them as quasi-mechanical. That which we owe to narcotics is not an inspiration, but some counterfeit excitement and fury. Emerson's retreat from this implication of his ideas is hurried and anxious, as he insists that sublime vision comes to the pure and simple soul in a clean and chaste body. But he is grand and emphatic on the character of the mental state of true poetry. It is a condition, he writes, that helps the poet escape the custody of that body in which he is pent up, and of that jail yard of individual relations in which he is enclosed. Emerson describes well the romantic's impulse towards transcendent freedom, a release from the dull drudgery of daily life. Images like these of imprisonment and release abound in his work, as they do in those of his contemporary, Henry David Thoreau, 1817-62. We meet them too in the images contrasting the earthbound and free flight that recur in the poems of John Keats, 1795-1821, envying his nightingale, and Percy Bysshe Shelley, 1792-1822, saluting the skylark, higher still and higher, from the earth thou springest, like a cloud of fire. A poem that, as Emerson puts it, speaks somewhat wildly is Samuel Taylor Coleridge's, 1772-1834, Kubla Khan. It begins, in Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph, the sacred river, ran, through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. Nothing in the poem tells us who this Kubla Khan is, and it has no narrative moment. But it is instantly effective, with its exotic names and settings. Abyssinia, Mount Abora, and Paradise come later, and the rhythmic excitement which tumbles the lines headlong towards that strongly stressed down, and the sudden flat expanse of the sunless sea. We are engaged, but we probably don't know why. As the poem continues, other equally mysterious but fascinating images follow. But oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a sedan cover, a savage place, as holy and enchanted, as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted, by women wailing for her demon lover. The woman wailing for her demon lover beneath a waning moon is a tremendously compelling image, but is actually only there as part of a simile to describe the savage place. In effect, the image of comparison does not serve to elaborate the deep romantic chasm. Instead, it disrupts the expectations of metaphor by taking over the interest of the lines. Then, as soon as it usurped the description and caught our fascination, it vanishes. We know no more of the woman or demon lover. We do, however, return to the chasm in a series of images of pell-mell violence, with the hectic eruption of the river from a mighty fountain, before meandering with a mazy motion. It sinks in tumult to a lifeless ocean. Strangely, ominously, at this moment, Kubla can hear ancestral voices prophesying war. So far, the poem seems to be alternating between images of peace and repose, in the picture of the stately pleasure dome, set in its grounds with gardens, an incense-bearing tree, and walls and towers. This recurs immediately after the voices as the shadow of the dome reappears, floating midway on the waves. Yet more strangely, it is now a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. All these images suggest a wondrous culture and civilization. But the alternating images are of the savage place, of the turbulent river out of whose roar can be heard these prophetic voices. Now it changes once more with another memorable image. A damsel with a dulcimer, in a vision once I saw, was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora. With the dulcet connotations of the instrument, the lines speak of a wondrous softness and ease. Now too we have another new presence, I. Moved by this vision, the newly revealed poet rises to a transport of creative enthusiasm. Could I revive within me her symphony and song, to such a deep delight 'twould win me, that with music loud and long, I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware. His flashing eyes, his floating hair, weave a circle around him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise. The exclamations, which are such a feature of the poem, become more numerous and intense in these lines, and they pour breathlessly onward in one sustained rapture. Yet, what does it mean? The poet says, I could revive within me. I would build. Perhaps he is writing of his anguished eagerness to recover his own creative strength, or, with less emphasis on revive, that he is inspired by this vision to emulate the wondrous creative labour of Kubla Khan and the Abyssinian maid. As his fever mounts, the point of view changes yet again, so that the poet is seen by all as he desires to be seen, an exciting, even dangerously demonic figure. The pace of the lines includes remarkable rhythmic changes. And all should cry, beware, beware. His flashing eyes, his floating hair, weave a circle around him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread. The second line can be conventionally scanned as a regular iambic tetrameter, like the first. But for me, the growing urgency makes it vault across just two strong stresses to a third line which begins with the forceful stress on weave, to the regular four beats of the fourth. This exhilarates the reader, catching us up into this strange thrill of the exotic and the possession of glamorous fantasy. Famously, this is where the poem ends. It is subtitled A Vision in a Dream, a fragment, for Coleridge said it was incomplete. Nor could he complete it, for he claimed that the poem was indeed the recollection of a dream, and that he was, instantly and eagerly, writing it down. He was, unfortunately, called out by a person on business from Porlock. By the time he returned to his vision and the paper, he found that the rest had passed away, like the images on the surface of a stream into which a stone has been cast. But alas, without the after restoration of the latter. This is a great story of the excitement and the fragility of the imagination. It suggests the utter mystery of the process, as Emerson has it, the mind flowing into and through things hardest and highest. The apparent mystery, however, has not prevented scholars from trying to uncover its more material sources. Coleridge wrote the poem after lodging overnight at a farmhouse at Culbone, near the Somerset Devon coast in southwest England. His biographer, Richard Holmes, convincingly describes how the steep, enclosed coombe, leading down from Culbone to the sea, might have encouraged Coleridge's imaginations of the sacred river. More securely, Coleridge himself tells us that he was reading Purchas Pilgrimage, a travel history which includes this passage. In Xanadu, did Kublai Khan build a stately palace encompassing 16 miles of plainer ground with a wall, wherein are fertile meadows, pleasant springs, delightful streams, and all sorts of beasts of chase and game, and in the midst thereof a sumptuous house of pleasure, which may be removed from place to place. Q.R. Holmes, 1989, Coleridge, Early Visions, page 163. Put this together with the note on the earliest known manuscript of the poem in which Coleridge describes it as a sort of reverie brought on by two grains of opium taken to check a dysentery. And a picture emerges of a poem resulting from some observations of the surrounding countryside. A bit of near copying from a book and the hallucination caused by medicine he had taken for an attack of diarrhea. So much, we might think, for the inscrutable mysteries of the imagination. But surely we should be wrong to think so. Even if we allow all these mundane contributions to the poem, the incomprehensible brilliance of the poem remains, and it is a brilliance that exceeds the subtlest interpretations, always finally elusive. The response of William Hazlitt in 1816 catches its quality when he writes, "It is not a poem but a musical composition." We could repeat the opening lines to ourselves, not the less often for not knowing the meaning of them. Quote, R. Holmes, Coleridge, Dark Reflections, 1998, page 434. Other readers have worried about not knowing the meaning. Coleridge's friend, the essayist Charles Lamb, 1775 to 1834, wrote to Wordsworth on 26th of April, 1816, about hearing Coleridge read Kubla Khan aloud.
"So enchantingly that it irradiates and brings heaven and Elysian bowers into my parlour while he sings or says it. But there is an observation, never tell thy dreams. And I am almost afraid that Kubla Khan is an owl that won't bear daylight. I fear lest it should be discovered by the lantern and clear reducing, to letters no better than nonsense or no sense." Quote, Holmes, Coleridge, Darker Reflections, pages 429 to 30. Lamb seems undecided whether to place the greater weight in his mind upon the irradiation the poem brings him, or on his anxiety that the cold light of examination will show it to be meaningless. He has not been alone. The poem retains its great ambivalence. Whatever it is about, and whatever the true nature of its inspiration, the poem, and the legend that surrounds it, is a great model of one kind of poetic imagination, and a great poem. Poetry and Liberation. In Chapter 5 on Free Verse, we saw how William Blake saw formal verse as a symptom of imprisonment. Poetry fettered fetters, the human race. His fellow romantics, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Keats, Shelley, and in America, Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman, and indeed the secluded Emily Dickinson, are all absorbed by the aspiration towards freedom. Their view of the range of the mind, conscious and unconscious, what they call imagination, is one part of this. For most, at least in their younger days, this striving for poetic freedom was part of a longing for political freedom, for the unfettered of the human race from poverty and oppressive government. The first generation of Romantic poets, notably Blake, Wordsworth, and Coleridge, spent their youth amid the ferment of change that brought about the American Revolution of 1776 and the French Revolution of 1789. The second generation of Byron, Shelley, and Keats were also politically radical. In a very large degree, Romantic poetry is a poetry of liberation, sometimes as in poems such as Shelley's England in 1819 or his The Mask of Anarchy, Protest, and The Hope of Freedom are rhetorically expressed. But for poetry, the idea of liberation must amount to more than serving as propaganda. The Romantic account of poetry, which sees it as the inspired space of imagination, dramatically marks it off from other kinds of language. Poetry does not only look and sound different because of its peculiar formal characteristics, but its relation to language is quite other. Other, that is, to the way language normally works, which is to convey consecutive narratives or arguments in sentences governed by the efficient rules of syntax. We have already seen in Chapter 3, Tones of Voice, how Edward Kaimu Brathwaite, in his Caribbean epic, The Arrivance, departs from the metropolitan norms of poetic style and voice. This includes pushing beyond the conventions that include grammar and spelling. But this isn't no big. Would we hat in hand, no speak when we spoke in two, for two, long how was afraid to speak, far too long frightened and weak. This is a poetry of liberation of our own day that is reworking the way poetry is written at the most immediate level. Necessarily, the speaker and hearer, or writer and reader, share the norms of communication and would prefer not to mystify one another. Nonetheless, the romantic ideas and processes of imagination and inspiration present a radical challenge to poetry as rhetoric. As Charles Lamb's Unease demonstrates with a poem like Kubla Khan, the nature of the communication is different. It does not fall readily within the dominant circle of making sense. It may be, as Lamb fears, no sense. It is with these ideas in mind that I now want to move to consider poetry in the context and practice of one of the most profound liberation movements of our own day. The liberation of women. Feminist poetics. In the last 50 years or so, the profile of poetry written by women, both past and present, has risen considerably, and as a result, at least three topics have presented themselves. The first might be called historical, and has to do with the revaluation of women poets of the past, whose work has been passed over by literary history. Second, there is the question of subject matter. Have women poets written about different topics by virtue of their interests and experience as women? Third, there is a more complex and controversial discussion
about the language and style of poetry by women. Is it fundamentally distinct from that of men at the level of language and form? More controversially, should women poets strive to write in ways that are clearly female and owe less and less to the predominantly male poetic tradition? If poetry is itself other with respect to conventional language use, is women's poetry other in a yet further respect? These are the issues I want to discuss in this section. In an essay called The Woman Poet, Her Dilemma, the contemporary Irish poet Yvan Bolan, 1944-2020, writes that the beginning woman poet very quickly becomes conscious of the silences that have preceded her and which still surround her. Women are a minority within the expressive poetic tradition. Much of their experience lacks even the most rudimentary poetic precedent. These silences are those of all the women who might have written, but for the assumptions of masculine dominance. They will become an indefinable part of her purpose as a poet. Bolan's argument is that the overwhelming masculine presence in the poetic tradition inhibits and excludes the woman poet. Poetry is the one, and she is the other. As Elizabeth Barrett Browning, 1806-61, wrote, "I look everywhere for grandmothers and see none." Many poets and scholars in recent years have sought to discover or rediscover these grandmothers. Aside from the anthologies of women's poetry, the newer historical anthologies of poetry in English published for the academic market now feature work entirely absent from their predecessors of even 20 years ago. Two examples are Roger Lonsdale's 18th Century Women Poets, 1990, and British Literature, 1640-1789, 2007, edited by Robert de Maria Jr. One of de Maria's new inclusions is this poem by Anna Letitia Barbauld, 1743-1825. It is called Washing Day and begins in neoclassical manner with the Muses. The Muses are turned gossips. They have lost their buskined step and clear high-sounding phrase. Language of gods, come then, domestic muse, in slipshod measure, loosely prattling on, of farm and orchard, pleasant curds and cream, or drowning flies or shoe lost in the mire, by little whimpering boy with rueful face. Come, muse, and sing the dreaded washing day. Like many other poems in this collection, Barbauld's poem is not to be found in many previous anthologies of 18th century poetry, precisely because such a subject would not have been deemed fit for poetry. Even when treated in the wry and ironic manner in which Barbauld approaches it. It is perhaps significant that at least one female poet of a later generation has not felt these particular inhibitions forcefully as she began her writing career. Kim Moore, 1981 to date, won the prestigious British Poetry Award, the Forward Prize, in 2023 for her book, All the Men I Never Married, writes in correspondence with me that although she knows that some of her contemporaries feel the absence of grandmothers, it is not something that she herself has felt. She refers to a school anthology in which she discovered a love for the poetry of Tennyson and Hardy in particular, but only recently realized that it contained no poetry by women. She writes, "So, the history of poetry is, of course, important to me. And it's mainly made up of men, and that's okay. I can read and enjoy and get lots from their poems, even whilst knowing, at a bodily and intellectual level, that they were writing these poems, I wouldn't have been able or allowed to write. That tension is not a silencing for me, though. It feels interesting and alive with possibility." She has, however, experienced attempts to police or influence what she writes about with a list of disapproved topics. Here we arrive at the second topic, concerning women's poetry. Subject matter. Where is the justifying precedent for writing about women's actual experience, subjects that have always been a central part of women's lives, such as domestic tasks and childcare? What Bolland calls the snips and threads of an ordinary day. It might be argued that the dreaded washing day is a slight matter, and that attending to it only reinforces women's domestic role. But that would not be a reason to exclude a poem like Mary Jones's. Unknown to 1778. After the smallpox, which is a mordant criticism of the masculine perceptions that oblige women to rely on a pretty face. Pope's The Rape of the Lock, 1714, is fascinated with female beauty, and smallpox is a real, if showy, presence in his poem. But it was poets like Jones and Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, 1689 to 1762, in her poem The Smallpox, who can tell us of the woman's pain at hiding this lost, inglorious face. How false and trifling is that art you boast! No art can give me back my beauty lost. In tears, surrounded by my friends, I lay, masked o'er, and trembling at the light of day. The work of recovery of barely noticed women poets is changing the perception of past poetry and helping fill the silences that Bolland laments. However, progress in this area has not meant that Kim Moore's list of policed topics does not include hair, since it is a subject men are not interested in, apparently. This re-examination of what poetry might be written about has also drawn 20th century women poets to reconsider some of the celebrated biblical and classical myths featuring women, such as the stories of Eve, Medusa, Persephone, and Eurydice, that feature in the tradition. H.D., Hilda Doolittle, 1886 to 1961, rewrote the story of Helen of Troy in her long poem Helen in Egypt, and more recently Carol Ann Duffy, 1955 to date, has fashioned a satirical retelling of mythical stories from the woman's point of view in her volume The World's Wife. In her retelling, the mythical Cretan aviator, whose pride in his artificial wings led him to fly too close to the sun, is about to take off from a hillock. Watching him, the long-suffering Mrs. Icarus ruefully concludes that her husband is yet another total, utter, absolute, grade A pillock. So these are two of the issues regarding women and poetry. The historical matter concerning equality of attention to poetry by women, both past and present, and the revision and extension of subject matter, both bear upon the confidence and opportunity available to the beginning poet. But besides these, is that third topic, is poetry by women, marked as such by its different use of language and form? How is it? Or how might it be different? One response to this question has come in the poetry and prose of the American poet Adrienne Rich, 1929 to 2012. In an influential essay, When We Dead Awaken, Writing as Revision, 1971, Rich makes her argument by describing the evolution of her own poetic career. She characterizes her early work as formal and distantly impersonal, in that it uses meter, rhyme, and stanza form, and strives for an objective, observant tone. She quotes her poem, Aunt Jennifer's Tigers, 1951, in which a woman is embroidering a screen. This is the middle stanza. Aunt Jennifer's fingers flutter through her wool, find even the ivory needle hard to pull. The massive weight of Uncle's wedding band sits heavily upon Aunt Jennifer's hand. The voice of these early poems was either third person or cast in a male persona. Formal style, she writes, acted, like asbestos gloves, it allowed me to handle materials I couldn't pick up barehanded. But gradually the character of her work changed. Her new work was jotted in fragments during children's naps, brief hours in the library, or at 3 a.m. after rising with a wakeful child. I despaired of doing any continuous work at this time. Yet I began to feel that my fragments and scraps had a common consciousness and a common theme, one which I would have been very unwilling to put on paper at an earlier time, because I had been taught that poetry should be universal, which meant, of course, non-female. Until then, I had tried very much not to identify myself as a female poet. On Lies, Secrets and Silence, 1980, page 44. These fragments and scraps develop into a freer, less formal style, and she eventually finds the confidence to use the pronoun I. She cites her poem, Thinking of Caroline Herschel, 1750-1848, astronomer, sister of William, and others, as one where at last the woman in the poem and the woman writing the poem become the same person. I am a galactic cloud so deep, so involuted, that a light wave could take 15 years to travel through me, and has taken, am an instrument in the shape of a woman trying to translate pulsations into images, for the relief of the body and the reconstruction of the mind. Unlike the voice of Aunt Jennifer's tigers, the truly female poet will turn away from the inherited forms of the male-dominated tradition and be marked by a freer verse style, in the manner of the field composition we saw in Chapter 5, free verse, and by confidently assuming the pronoun I. For Rich, feminist poets is liberationist, and therefore romantic. It challenges previous forms, is iconoclastic, towards the tradition. Indeed, rejects the viability and desirability of a single tradition, and it values subjective experience and its expression. But none of this is uncontroversial. Iavan Bolland, whilst admiring Rich, is sceptical towards what she senses as separatist thinking, and the identification of the poet, male or female, as a romantic outsider. She writes in her essay, In Search of a Language, "The poet vocation, or more precisely, the historical construction put upon it, is one of the single most problematic areas for any woman who comes to the craft. Not only has it been defined by a tradition which could never foresee her, but it is constructed by men about men, in ways which are poignant, compelling, and exclusive." E. Bolland, 1995, Object Lessons, page 80. She argues against that exclusion, that women have a birthright in poetry, and must have the fullest possible dialogue with the poetry of the past, most of which is male. She warns too against what she calls the romantic heresy, the turn towards the subjective in poetry, since Wordsworth has often declined, she believes, into self-consciousness and self-invention. She is worried that women poets might replicate romantic ideas which have asserted the realm of imagination as so separate from, so different in kind, as to be incompatible with the process and experience of daily life. Her own poetry is not averse to the matter of fact either in setting or diction, as the opening to this poem, Contingencies, suggests. Waiting in the kitchen for power cuts, on this wet night, sorting candles, feeling the tallow, brings back to me the way women spoke in my childhood, with a sweet mildness in front of company, or with a private hunger in whispered kisses, or with the crisis bright words, which meant, you, and you alone, were their object. Bolland's style is one which aims to maintain connections with ideas and language as they are current outside the spaces of poetry. If for Rich, the female poet must rise up from the kitchen table, for Bolland, it is a place to work. Her own subjectivity is part of her poetry, as it is of her essays. But she is also a poet of argument, not at all drawn towards no sense. Yet many writers do envision a female writing whose difference from male practice is deeply inscribed in how the language is used. In her essay, The Laugh of the Medusa, the contemporary French writer Hélène Sixou, 1937 to date, writes,
"Nearly the entire history of writing is confounded with the history of reason, for which it is at once the effort, the support, and one of the privileged alibis."
Translation by Keith Cohen and Paula Cohen. Signs. Volume 1, Number 4. Summer, 1976. Pages 875 to 893. For Sixou, then, real female writing will exist outside what I called earlier the dominant circle of making sense. Thus, it might seem possible to recognize an alliance of others. Women stand outside these masculine norms, and so does poetic imagination, which, from the point of view of reason, makes no sense. In some poets, including men, she glimpses opposition to this dominance. In A Rhetoric, as strikingly urgent in its images of imprisonment and liberation as that of Emerson, she writes,
"There has been poets who would go to any lengths to slip something by at odds with the tradition, men capable of loving love, and hence capable of loving others, and of wanting them, of imagining the woman who would hold out against oppression, and constitute herself as a superb, equal, and hence impossible subject, untenable in a real social framework."
Page 320. But can this vision be seen in specific poems? Does Kubla Khan slip something by at odds with the tradition? Does the poetic other have a further female dimension? Some critics have seen the composure of masculine techniques, such as the iambic pentameter, and indeed grammar itself, as targets for subversion by female poets. Biographically, it is easy to represent the reclusive Emily Dickinson, 1830 to 86, as so at odds with her circumstances as to be an impossible subject, unable to be at ease in the real social framework of a small New England town. But her deep transgressive difference at the level of language and style is often now seen in her rough, broken surfaces and distorted hymn stanzas. Here are the last two stanzas of a poem which begins,
"Why do they shut me out of heaven? Wouldn't the angels try me just once more? Just see if I troubled them, but don't shut the door. Oh, if I were a gentleman in the white robe, and they with a little hand that knocked, could I forbid?"
Dickinson violates conventional syntax, ignores expectations to be more transparent, and is simply irregular, even in her punctuation. Perhaps here we can see the kind of rejection of reasonable male writing that Sixou and others seek. Women's poetry, and ideas about it, is a rapidly changing and disparate field. To recur to my three topics, poets, scholars, and readers, mainly women, continue to revalue the historical legacy. The resulting discoveries, and the writing of our contemporaries, are expanding ideas of what subjects poetry can take on. The third topic is more complex. All theories about poetry have prescriptions to claim that poems should be written this way and not that, because in these times, writing by women is urgently connected to social and political imperatives. The searches for definition and prescription are understandably forceful. To be free of the inherited forms of the male-dominated tradition was obviously going to be a desire of women writing. I think that its radical edge is bound up with the alternatives to the consecutive norms of rational process, embodied in the notion of the imagination and the notion of inspiration. But if we look at women poets since the 17th century, or closer to our own time, at poets considered in this book like Edna St. Vincent Millay and Marianne Moore, highly formal poets writing in the current of the tradition, can we say with confidence that in the styles and subjects they adopted, they were wrong from the start? It is true that Csikszentmihalyi has claimed that
there has not yet been any writing that inscribes femininity.
And how secure a definition of femininity can there be? A confident poet of the present generation, Kim Moore, denies that there is, or can be, a singular female voice in poetry, any more than a distinctively male voice. How different female use of language really is, still needs and is receiving subtler analysis. A great deal of life in the writing and reading of contemporary poetry is energized by these questions, and out of it will come new poems to surprise us beyond our current imaginings. Summary. In this final chapter, we have considered the working of simple metaphor and image in speech and in poetry, and some more complex instances. The historical debates around the relation of words and metaphor, in particular to the representation of reality. The purpose and character of rhetoric in relation to poetry. The concepts of imagination and inspiration, and the impact they have had on poetry and ideas about poetry and the poet. How these concepts are allied to liberationist ideas.